Welcome to the Intro Biology Podcast. Today we'll be discussing carbon and organic chemistry. So carbon is an element whose atoms make up nearly all biological molecules that we study in biology. One of the remarkable properties that carbon has is the ability to form four bonds with other atoms, and those other atoms can be other carbon atoms or other biologically relevant and abundant atoms such as hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. When we talk about carbon, we're talking about organic molecules. So molecules that contain carbon are organic molecules. And organic chemistry is the study of carbon-containing compounds. And historically, it was believed that you could only get organic compounds from living organisms. That is, that living organisms were the ones who were synthesizing organic compounds. And the types of compounds that we're talking about is really all of the major macromolecule types found in biological systems. So for example, carbohydrates are containing carbon backbones that can be ring structures or linear structures of different lengths and sizes. You can also have lipids that are long chains of carbons that are stuck together that form the surfaces of cells, for example. Proteins are made up of amino acids, and every amino acid backbone contains two carbon atoms, and then the side chains on those amino acids can contain many more carbon atoms, but the very backbone of amino acids that form proteins contain carbon atoms. Nucleic acids that make up the building blocks of DNA and RNA also contain carbon atoms. Neurotransmitters contain carbon backbones as well. So really all major types of molecules that we find in biological systems contain carbon atoms. As was said, one of the original hypotheses was that only living organisms could produce organic matter, organic compounds. One experiment was performed to see whether or not that was the case. Really, they were testing to see, could you form organic compounds without living organisms? And this experiment was called the Miller-Urey experiment. And what it tried to do was to combine the chemicals that were believed to have existed in the early Earth many million years ago. And if you could combine them under certain conditions that you might have expected in the early Earth, what could you generate? And so what they did was they combined water that was believed to exist in the early Earth with some heat. And then in the gaseous form, they had molecules that they thought were abundant in the early Earth atmosphere, such as methane, CH4, ammonia, NH3, hydrogen gas, H2. And so they heated water to produce steam. They then mixed that steam with those chemicals, those gaseous chemicals, and they introduced electrical shocks, kind of to simulate lightning strikes. And then they collected any chemicals or molecules that were formed in that reaction and tested to see what they were. And interestingly, just that reaction of heating water to make steam, combining that steam with gaseous methane, ammonia, and hydrogen, introducing a shock could produce organic molecules. And what they found that they collected was formaldehyde, hydrogen cyanide, and even some amino acids and hydrocarbons. And so this was evidence these researchers proposed that, or put forward, that you could in fact synthesize organic molecules without living organisms. One caveat to this experiment was that the gases that they introduced, such as methane and ammonia, were not as abundant in the early Earth, we now know now, as they believed they were when they conducted their experiment. And so, just to say that there might be some uncertainty about the results of that experiment. So now returning to carbon and its unique ability to form four bonds with other atoms. As we mentioned in previous episodes of the podcast, carbon has four valence electrons in its outermost shell. Those electrons are all unpaired, and so each one of them is able to form one covalent bond. So carbon can form four covalent bonds with other atoms. When an atom forms four bonds with other atoms, it takes on a shape, a three-dimensional shape that's called tetrahedral. So if you can imagine a pyramid-like structure, in which the carbon atom is at the center and the four other atoms to which it is bound are kind of spread out equally from one another to form roughly a pyramid shape, you have what's called a tetrahedron, or a tetrahedral geometry for that carbon atom. In a perfect tetrahedron, each of those atoms, the bonds that connect carbon to each of those atoms, are exactly 109.5 degrees apart. So in the perfect example where carbon is bound to four different hydrogen atoms called methane, each of those carbon-hydrogen bonds is exactly 109.5 degrees away from every other carbon-hydrogen bond. When you start forming bonds with other atoms that aren't hydrogen and different types of atoms, or if you had lone pairs, then the bond angles begin to change. But in general, when an atom like carbon is able to form four equal covalent bonds, those bonds are 109.5 degrees apart. Carbon can not only form four individual covalent bonds, it can also form double bonds. So for example, when carbon binds to two different oxygen atoms to form carbon dioxide, it forms a double bond or two covalent bonds with each of those oxygen atoms. Again, each bond uses one of the unpaired electrons from carbon. So two of the unpaired electrons form a bond with two of the unpaired electrons on one oxygen atom, and the other two unpaired electrons on carbon form covalent bonds with the two unpaired electrons on the other oxygen atom. So now you have carbon with two double bonds going to two different oxygen atoms. A common term that you'll hear mentioned a lot when we talk about carbon-containing molecules is a carbon skeleton or a carbon backbone. Hydrocarbons describe molecules that are chains or links of carbons to one another where those carbons are bound to hydrogen atoms. So hydrocarbon is hydrogen and carbon atoms stuck together. And this would be something like a fatty acid. So the hydrocarbon chains on fatty acids are one example of this. Those chains can have a lot of diversity in their shapes and their structures. So for example, they can be of different lengths. You could have two carbons or three carbons or four carbons and many, many more carbons stuck together in the chain. You could also have branching. So instead of one carbon being linked to one other carbon down the chain, you could have a carbon linked to two different carbons that begin to branch off in different directions. So you can have unbranched and branched carbon skeletons. As we mentioned before, carbons can form not only single bonds, but also double bonds and even triple bonds, but they can form double bonds with other carbon atoms within a chain. And where those double bonds are in that chain is another level of diversity for how they can arrange themselves. Carbon also, interestingly, can form rings or cyclic structures. So you can imagine if you had a five-membered carbon ring, and you could stretch that out and make it five carbons in a linear chain, or you could link two of those carbons together to make a five-membered ring or a six-membered ring that is commonly found in some organic molecules. And so the length of carbon chains, the branching of carbon chains, the position of double bonds in those chains, and the presence of rings is different ways that carbon-containing molecules can arrange themselves. In addition to our discussion of the different configurations of carbon-containing chains or compounds, we have to discuss variability in those structures, and the term we're introducing here is isomers. Isomers are compounds with the same numbers of atoms of the same elements, but with different structures and therefore different properties. So one of the variabilities we mentioned just prior was that carbon can be arranged in linear chains or branched chains. And so you can imagine you could have the same chemical formula where you have five carbons in a linear chain, or you could take one of those carbons off, make it a four-membered chain, and then stick that carbon somewhere in the middle to make a branch. You haven't changed the number of carbon atoms in that chain, and if they were all bound to hydrogens, you haven't changed the number of hydrogens in that molecule, but you now have changed its structure. And so a structural isomer are molecules with the same molecular formula, so the same number of carbons and hydrogens and whatever other atoms there are, but different covalent arrangements, that is, different bond arrangements of their atoms. So like we said, you can have a linear chain or a branched chain, and if they have the same molecular formula, same number of carbons, hydrogens, and other atoms, they are structural isomers. Another type of isomer is called a cis-trans or a geometric isomer. And these types of isomers are only considered when you have a double bond. So imagine for a second, carbon could have four different bonds to different atoms, or it can contain a double bond. Imagine you have two carbons held together by a double bond, and each of those carbons is bound to two different groups. So the carbon on the left is bound to a hydrogen and some other atom, and the carbon on the right is bound to a hydrogen and some other atom. If you can visualize that, imagine that you took one of the carbons and you rotated it. So in one scenario, you have the double bond and you have the hydrogens on the same side of the double bond, say on the top, if you're drawing it on paper. And if you flip one of those carbons over and put the hydrogen on bottom, now the hydrogens are on different sides of the covalent bond. And this is what we refer to when we say a cis-trans isomer. It's how the atoms bound to one of the two elements of the double bond is arranged. If two elements that are the same, two atoms that are the same, bound to those carbons in the double bond are on the same side of the double bond, we call that a cis isomer. If those two atoms are on different sides of the double bond, then it is a trans isomer. So cis and trans isomers only refer to molecules that have a double bond. When the atoms bound to the carbons in that double bond are on the same side, it's cis, and opposite side, it's trans. The last type of isomer we're going to discuss is called an enantiomer. And these are isomers that are mirror images of one another, and they differ in shape due to an asymmetric carbon. An asymmetric carbon is a carbon that's bound to four different groups. And if those groups are rearranged in such a way that it is the mirror image of the previous configuration, we refer to that as an enantiomer. Just a comment here that there will be a few ways that enantiomers are denoted, and those can be the D and L isomer referring to one or the other. You might also see them referred to as R or S or even plus and minus. That's more something to understand the differences between in chemistry. For our biological purposes, just understanding that mirror images of one another, those isomers are called enantiomers. And another way you can think about these is like your right and your left hand. Your right and your left hand are roughly mirror images of one another. The important thing is if you lay them on top of one another, say with your palms down, they don't line up. The thumb of one hand goes to one side and the thumb of the other hand goes to the other side. So they are not the same, but they are mirror images of one another. And that's what an enantiomer is. To discuss a bit more about cis-trans isomers and how they are biologically relevant, one context to think about this in is fatty acids. These are hydrocarbons, carbons bound to other carbons and hydrogen atoms, that are one of the ways that energy is stored in the cell, particularly in fatty acids. And they also have a relationship to nutrition and the foods we eat. So a saturated fatty acid that you may have heard about, particularly on nutrition fact labels, is a hydrocarbon where every carbon is bound to other carbons and hydrogens, and there are no double bonds. So we would say that the fatty acid is saturated with hydrogens. An unsaturated fatty acid is one in which there are double bonds, and it's called unsaturated because you remove two hydrogens to form that double bond. The electrons that were bound to hydrogen are now bound to each other. So there's a carbon-carbon double bond, at least one somewhere in the fatty acid chain to be an unsaturated fatty acid. As we mentioned previously, the isomers of double bonds are called cis and trans isomers based on whether or not the like atoms are on the same or different sides of the double bond. When you see the word unsaturated fatty acid on a nutrition label, that's referring to a cis double bonded unsaturated fatty acid. That is a carbon-carbon double bond where the hydrogens are on the same side of the double bond and the rest of the carbons are on the same side of the double bond. A trans fat is also known as a trans unsaturated fatty acid. It also has a double bond, but that double bond is in the trans configuration, and so those hydrogens are on opposite sides of the double bond, and those other carbons are on opposite sides of the double bond. You may have heard that trans fats are worse for you than unsaturated fatty acids, cis double bonded unsaturated fatty acids, like they're found in vegetable oil. And that's because trans fats are metabolically more difficult to break down in the body. So that's why they're considered less healthy. And those are often found in some types of margarine. One other biological example of cis trans isomers is the way that our eyes detect light. And the way that this works is that there is a chemical found inside of the retina of the eye called retinal, R-E-T-I-N-A-L, retinal, and it exists in two configurations, the cis and the trans isomer, based on the position around a double bond in the molecule. What happens is that the retinal is normally in the cis isomer configuration, but when it's exposed to light, like when light enters the eye, that changes the configuration from the cis to the trans isomer. That changes the shape of the molecule. It actually elongates it and stretches it out. When it's elongated and stretches out, it actually changes the shape of the protein that retinal is found in. And that in turn sends a signal from the eye to the brain that light has been perceived. So that's one example of how cis-trans isomers are relevant in biology. Some examples of how enantiomers are relevant in biology would be in how certain drugs are manufactured and delivered. So roughly speaking, when drugs are synthesized, the synthesis reaction usually produces the two mirror images of the drug. One of the mirror images, one enantiomer, is the active form of the drug, and usually the other enantiomer, the other mirror image version of the drug, is just the inactive form. Usually it doesn't do anything harmful to the body, it's just inactive. It doesn't do the same thing as the other enantiomer does. Ibuprofen, for example, when it's synthesized, there are two enantiomers that are produced. One of them is effective. It just happens to be the S-ibuprofen version, and the R-ibuprofen is ineffective. Albuterol, if you've ever taken an inhaler, the drug that's often in inhalers, the R-albuterol enantiomer is the active one, and the S-albuterol is the inactive one. Now, I say usually that's the case, that the other enantiomer is just inactive or ineffective, but in some instances, the other enantiomer is not just ineffective, it's actually harmful. And one very common example of this was the morning sickness drug thalidomide that was prescribed to pregnant mothers who were experiencing morning sickness, and this drug would help relieve those symptoms. One of the enantiomers of this drug during synthesis did act that way, but unfortunately it was not well understood when it was first made that the other enantiomer actually is harmful, and it's particularly harmful to the developing baby inside of the mother's womb. So mothers took this drug for their morning sickness, and unfortunately their babies were harmed and they were born with birth defects. And then after a little bit of time when this was realized, that drug was removed from the shelves. But that's one example of when it's not the case that the other enantiomer is inactive. It can actually have other off-target effects, we would say. So just to summarize what we talked about in this lesson, carbon has the ability to form four covalent bonds because it has four unpaired valence electrons in its outermost or its valence shell. Carbon is then able to form four individual covalent bonds. It can also form double bonds or even triple bonds with those electrons. Carbon appears in nearly all biologically important molecules, including carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. And you can also have different arrangements of the same atoms in a molecule, but they can give it drastically different properties. And we talked about things like structural isomers, where you have different arrangements of the same atoms, cis-trans isomers, when you have different configurations about a double bond, and enantiomers that are the same chemical but rearranged so that they are mirror images of one another.